This is the Takeaway Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry in the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Our focus is straight up Interstate 95 to Washington, D.C., where Congress and the Federal Reserve have the fragile U.S. economic recovery in their hands. Coming up, we'll talk with Georgia Congressman Lynn Westmoreland, who is one of the Republicans leading the way toward a showdown, a possible showdown, over the federal budget and a partial repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Congressman will make that argument that may lead to a government shutdown between now and October 1st, when the Affordable Care Act begins to take effect for most Americans. That's the plan, anyway. The fiscal battle and another battle over the debt ceiling in Congress could have harrowing consequences for the economic recovery. But the economic recovery is also at risk, or at least in play, in a crucial meeting at the Federal Reserve, the final day of a two-day meeting, and at the top of the agenda, a decision to move away from the $85 billion per month stimulus program called quantitative easing. Also looming is the question of who will succeed Ben Bernanke when his term as chair of the Federal Reserve ends in January, with Larry Summers out and the markets apparently thrilled about that. The new presumptive frontrunner seems to be Janet Yellen, current vice chair of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve and a supporter of the quantitative easing approach, at least according to her statements on the record. Susan M. Phillips joins us now. She served on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve from 1991 to 1998, overlapping at one point with Janet Yellen. She joins us from Virginia. Susan Phillips, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
So Janet Yellen, unlike many of her colleagues on the Federal Reserve, seems to be very, very quiet about the idea of tapering back, moving away from the $85 billion per month stimulus. She's the only one that's been quiet. What, first of all, is her position on quantitative easing? Supportive?
Well, I'm sure she is. She was there and involved in the formation of the program. So she's been there to vote on it several times.
And this $85 billion a month program purchases treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities. And it's our understanding that moving away from it means that both of those purchases will be reduced. What's the difference between reducing purchasing of treasury bonds or reducing purchasing of mortgage-backed securities? What's the impact on the economy?
Well, you know, each of those securities trades in somewhat different markets. Obviously, they have different risk characteristics, and they also have different lengths of time to maturity. So it will affect interest rates at different points along the yield curve, and also just affect the liquidity in those two separate markets.
So the availability of money will be affected, and interest rates could spike for mortgages and for credit cards and the like.
Well, obviously, I think that they're going to, if they do anything, they're going to do it in a very staged, slow, careful manner. So they're going to try to do everything to avoid spiking of interest rates.
But an incremental increase is what the impact would be on the economy. If consumers want to pay attention to anything, it would be interest rates.
Not so much short-term rates, because they have committed to keep short-term rates low. So they're not really touching those. It's more on the longer end. But it would be very. My suspicion is it would be very minor.
What's Janet Yellen's position on inflation? Is she viewed as a hawk that if inflation rears its head, we can expect a very quick action on monetary policy, or is she more of a dove on this sort of thing?
Well, of course, when I was with her on the Fed, we had higher inflation, and at that time she was very supportive of trying to get inflation down. So I think it's very hard to categorize people as either a hawk or a dove. It depends on where inflation is, and right now it's very quiet. So she's probably not as concerned about it at this point.
You know, one of the remarkable things about the tenure of Ben Bernanke is how concerned, particularly in the last three or four years, he's been about unemployment, about improving the job situation in the economy. Do you see continuity if Janet Yellen were to replace Ben Bernanke with that focus of the Federal Reserve on jobs, something we really haven't seen except in this era?
I do think that there would be continuity. She obviously has been involved in the formation of the current policies and has been supportive of them and is on the record as being so. So, yes, it would be more of a continuation of the current sort of philosophy and analysis that goes on at the Fed.
The markets really hated the idea of Larry Summers. Does that mean that the markets don't believe that we can survive without quantitative easing?
I think with Larry Summers that people just didn't know as much about his position on monetary policy. He's dealt more in a broader range of economic issues in his public jobs, and he's not been at the Federal Reserve. So I think it was as much that people just didn't know that much about him. But we've gotten into this quantitative easing program, and I think everybody knows at some point it's going to have to end. But the question is, how do you end it, and when do you end it, and at what rate do you end it?
And that's exactly what the Fed is considering. Susan Phillips served on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve from 1991 to 1998, overlapping at one point with Fed Governor front runner Janet Yellen. Susan Phillips, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. Any sense of an economic recovery could be scuttled by what's going on in Congress right now. We are joined by Republican Congressman Lynn Westmoreland, member of the House Committee on Financial Services. He represents Georgia's 3rd Congressional District. Welcome, Congressman.
Thank you, John.
Do you think the economic recovery is threatened by any of the debates in Congress, including a debate over the Affordable Care Act, the debate over a government shutdown, a possible government shutdown, and even the debt ceiling?
Well, John, you have to remember that the Affordable Care Act affects about 16 to 17% of our economy. So I certainly think that if this thing does go into effect in January of 2014, it is going to be a drag on the economy. But the economy, you know, we've had 5 years. This has been the slowest recovery from a recession in history. So at this particular point, it's very fragile, but I don't know how much worse we could hurt it.
What do you think of the effort to put defunding of the Affordable Care Act into the continuing resolution or the funding of the government resolution?
Well, John, what Tom Graves has done is dropped the bill. Right now, we've got about 72 co-sponsors on it, and it's the Stability, the Security, and the Fairness Act. And stability because it funds the government for 1 year, CR, at the post-sequester rate. It includes the 3 appropriations bills that has passed the House, which is the Veterans, Homeland Security, and DOD, which gives them more flexibility with the budget. And then it's fair because it delays and defunds Obamacare or Affordable Care Act for 1 year for individuals, just like it's been delayed for businesses and other special interest groups. This delays it for the American citizen for that 1 year. I think people are finally starting to read the bill. I know the labor unions are starting to read the bill. Some of the Medicaid states are starting to read the bill and understand that that's going to be unaffordable for them. So this thing, I think, is one of the Democratic senators says it's not ready for prime time.
What do you make of the argument that Democrats say it's the law of the land, the function of the government, the job of the government is now to implement this law? If Congress wants to revisit health care, they can certainly do that in a new bill that would amend this. So this is just not the way to do social policy. What do you make of that argument?
Well, John, I'm sure that the Affordable Care Act is not the first bad bill that's ever been passed up here. And when you do make a mistake, when you do something that is so comprehensive that nobody understands it, and you have to have 30,000 pages of rules and regulations. You have to have 111 new boards, commissions, agencies to administer this law. When you look at something like that, and if it's bad, then you need to change it or you need to fix it.
Don't you run the risk of revisiting a debate that Americans think is over? And if this doesn't get past the Senate, it will mean a government showdown. And then we're not talking about affordable care anymore. We're talking about the same kinds of debates that took place in the 90s during the Clinton era. And you know what happened to the GOP back then?
Well, let's look at it this way, John. I think, you know, the president and Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi are the ones that are continually talking about a government shutdown. It's not Republicans. That's the reason we call the bill stability, because it does fund the government for 1 year at the post-sequester rate. And so, I mean, we don't want to shut down the government. And if you look at the argument of this, what's wrong with having a one-year CR that gives the American people, the businesses, our federal agencies, the stability to know that they've at least got 1 year under this continuing resolution? I hate continuing resolutions, but the House hasn't done his job on passing all the appropriations bills. And then if you look at the security, who in the world could possibly have a problem with helping the DOD, who has taken the brunt of some of these sequester cuts, helping our veterans, our men and women that are on the front line every day, and then helping the Department of Homeland Security, the people that protect our homeland. I don't know how you could argue with that.
Are you on good speaking terms with House Speaker Boehner, who really opposes this effort by the 40 House Republicans? And what's your position on the debt ceiling if it comes to a vote?
Well, I think that the debt ceiling, we're going to have to see what type of cuts that we get. I think we've got to look at some of the mandatory spending that we do. And so right now, the debt ceiling, if it's just a clean debt ceiling vote, I'm going to vote no. And if it's got an appropriate amount of cuts and some real reforms in it, then I would certainly give it some consideration.
Speaker Boehner's not going to be happy about that, Congressman.
Well, he's not been happy with me a lot, so he's a good friend, and I like the speaker, but he's not been really approval of everything I've done.
Republican Congressman Lynn Westmoreland, member of the House Committee on Financial Services, represents Georgia's 3rd Congressional District. Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you, John.
Boy, you can hear the divisions in the GOP there. Later this hour, so much stuff. Why buy when you can rent? Why own when you can share? What do you proudly own and more proudly share?
Hi, my name is Stefan, and I'm from Seattle, Washington. And we use the Car2Go service on a regular basis. We even use it when we go out of town. We love it and hope to one day be a one-car family.
Nice. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Share your story with us. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It was cities in America that invented the political machine, one-party operations that choose who runs City Hall, with a little help from voters occasionally. Chicago has the Democratic machine, of course. They are all Democratic in the Windy City, right? And in this election season, the machines are geared up in races from Seattle to New York to Miami.
I love Atlanta. I grew up in this community. I'm Kasim Reed.
Hi, I'm Mike McGinn. I don't think this race is about style. I think it's about substance.
Francis looks at the city of Miami as his family. He's going to do what's right.
Only one candidate for mayor has already proven he's ready. Joe Loda.
Bill de Blasio will be a mayor for every New Yorker, no matter where they live or what they look like. And I'd say that even if he weren't my dad.
But this year, one-party rule has meant single-candidate contests for City Hall in at least two major American cities. Joining me now to talk about the controversy in these uncontested local races is Melissa Sanchez, City Hall reporter for El Nuevo Herald in Miami. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
And with me right here in Atlanta is Gene Bonner, State House reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Gene, welcome.
Great to be here.
So is it one-party rule here in Atlanta, Jean?
Well, you know, technically the race is nonpartisan. This election is a sharp contrast to Kasim Reed's first election, which was hardly fought. He had to go to a runoff, and then he ultimately won only by 700 points. And it's something that he actually almost says with a little bit of pride. You know, you can never count anyone out. You can never count anything out. To a certain extent, you could argue the fight was fought. You know, in the first time around.
And the voters don't necessarily have the appetite to do it again, and incumbency really means something here in Atlanta this time around.
Well, and I also think he has done a good job of carrying through with campaign promises and with tackling some big picture issues, but also some small issues. He likes to say he wants to do a number of small things well, and he has done that. One of the things that he's focused on is reopening all the recreation centers for kids, because he feels like that's a small thing, and yet it has all sorts of repercussions for the health of the city, crime, that kind of thing.
Small but very, very visible. Melissa Sanchez, is it one-party rule in Miami?
Well, like in Atlanta, it's supposed to be nonpartisan, but here everybody's Republican. It's a Cuban thing.
But
no, and what's happening here is pretty unique, because we had an opponent. We had a challenger to incumbent Mayor Tomas Regalado, but just 2.5 weeks ago, he suddenly dropped out of the race, claiming that it was because his wife has finally gotten pregnant after several years of trying. But in reality, his campaign had kind of fallen apart.
And political scandal is not something that people of Miami are, you know, I suppose they're not used to it, but it's very familiar, at least over the last two decades.
Yeah, I know it's incredibly familiar to voters here, especially because this candidate, Francis Suarez, his father had been removed from office for another voting fraud scandal back 10, 15 years ago. And I think folks here in Miami are really tired of politicians getting in trouble for voter fraud or for corruption. We just had 3 local mayors arrested on corruption charges, and another local mayor who is being investigated for tax evasion in relation to his loan shark deals.
We're talking with Melissa Sanchez, a City Hall reporter for El Nuevo Herald in Miami, and Jean Bonner, Georgia Public Broadcasting reporter, about mayoral races in Atlanta and Miami. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So to both of you, if there's a weariness in the electorate, does that affect the debates that should be going on civic issues that maybe aren't getting much profile, Melissa, this time around?
I think so. I mean, I think what's happened here is just a huge disservice to voters, because the incumbent, although he's popular with the elderly super voters who were used to coming out on the polls for Election Day in these municipal races, there's been some serious problems in the way the city has been run, especially in terms of the stability of its financial department. We have 2 ongoing SEC investigations currently. The Department of Justice just issued findings that the police department has engaged in unjustified shootings of Black people over the past few years. And these are issues that are no longer going to be debated. The incumbent mayor, although there's a couple of candidates that have no name recognition and no fundraising to their name, he doesn't have to defend himself, and he doesn't have to say what's going to happen next in the next 4 years. So I think it's problematic for voters who don't have any other choices. It's either the guy that we have now or nobody.
Jean Bonner, is the political debate in Atlanta degraded by the lack of a challenger?
Well, certainly there are some key issues where Kasim Reed has had to make difficult decisions. To a certain extent, you could argue, you know, he kind of won't be accountable. The thing that I'm thinking of particularly is that the Atlanta Falcons want a new stadium. Now, it involves a number of people. It also involves the state to a certain extent. But Kasim Reed has been, you know, the chief negotiator on this deal. And certainly there's been a real grassroots effort to say, we don't think any public money should be used in this stadium. If the Falcons want a new stadium, you know, that's a private company. Let them build the stadium all by themselves. Now, in the end, the Falcons are putting forward money in order to buy property from churches on the land where he wants to build. But you could argue that there's really not going to be a referendum. And in fact, a group did try to put it to a referendum and just couldn't collect enough votes.
So no contest at City Hall in November in Miami and Atlanta means no real debate over these civic issues. Jean Bonner is a State House reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Jean, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to Melissa Sanchez, reporter for El Nuevo Herald. Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
It's better to share, says your mom, right? When you say, mine, mine, mine. Later this hour, a shift in the economy to sharing. Are you a part of the shift?
Hi, this is Gift in San Francisco. I have used the Zipcar with some success, a bike share program in New York City. I think sharing is the way to go, particularly as we're trying to save the planet.
But one of you in Folkestone, Georgia, said, I've shared my neighbor's pickup before, but we don't have that stuff here in the swamp. For many of you, it's still mine, mine, mine. But bicycles are becoming more shareable, and that's why we're having a bike haiku challenge this week. To participate in our challenge, visit our website, thetakeaway.org. You'll find the rules. 10 winners will be getting takeaway bike helmets. Haikus, listen.
Two wheels bound with chain, beating hearts tied to nothing. We are young. Once more.
Modern metal steed, sturdy and ready to ride. Your power is mine.
Single speed commute keeps the legs in shape to race. Carbon frame beauty.
You guys are great. This is the takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
In the contest between humanity and the environment, it is easy to throw in the towel sometimes. Growing population and demand for energy produces impacts on the climate that seem impossible to reverse. The severity of floods, storms, and wildfires seem to be on an ever-upward climb. Environmental activist Bill McKibben goes straight to the heart of this sense of paralysis about the environment and humanity's growing impact on it in his new book, Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. It's the story of how one farmer fought to keep his honeybees from succumbing to environmental contamination, and the story of how many activists got together to stop a massive oil pipeline. Together, Bill McKibben says the stories make the case that in a global warming world, humanity is still in the fight.
We have all kinds of reasons to be optimistic if we get to work. We look this summer at a country like Germany, the one country that took renewable energy seriously. There were days this year they generated more than half the power they used from solar panels within their borders. Think what we could do here. What we have to do is engage in that battle, and we got to do it locally to make places that work, that are hardy, resilient, self-reliant, and we have to rejigger the structure under which we price fossil fuel, all those other technical things that would allow us some real hope of the speedy transition that would head off the worst of climate change. At the moment, we're not having rational discussions about this in Washington.
What did the beekeeper, your neighbor, teach you about the ability that we have, even on a small scale, to fight the environmental factors we see around us?
Kirk Webster is a remarkable apiarist, the first really chemical-free apiarist in the country, and built a very successful bee yard, bee farm, that's survived the colony collapse disorder, all the other craziness that's affecting bees, who are a kind of early warning system for the trouble that we're in. He taught me a lot, and truthfully, the bees taught me a lot. I'd never paid that much attention to bees before, but they turn out to be remarkable creatures. We think about the queen bee as being really important, but in fact, she's really good at laying eggs. It's the rest of the hive that manages to conduct itself in a kind of leaderless and powerful way. And for me, that became a metaphor for the kind of movement that we're trying to build to fight climate change. We don't have any great leaders, no Martin Luther Kings. What we have are an interconnected thousands of groups around the country and around the world who understand that they're fighting against the fossil fuel industry close to home, but that that fight also has a global dimension and that we're able to come together. That's why, you know, this huge divestment fight against fossil fuels so interesting now on hundreds of college campuses. It's why the fight against Keystone XL turned into the iconic environmental fight of our time. When I get depressed about those things, I think about the bees who seem not to get depressed day in or day out, seem merely to get up and go to work. And that's become sort of my philosophy, too, I think.
Bill McKibben, we've talked a lot over many, many years, going really back 20 years, a lot of discussions about science, a lot of discussions about politics. But I think in this book, you formulated an argument, which I'm wondering if it's too romantic, to suggest that fighting the Keystone Pipeline isn't so much politics as it is human adaptation to environmental threat in the same way that the bees responded in Kirk Webster's hive.
Look, by now, forget about bees. What's happening with climate is an interesting test of whether the big brain was a good adaptation or not. And we're going to find out in our time. It can clearly get us into some trouble. Can it get us out? Is it attached to a big enough heart to let us deal with the trouble that we've stumbled into?
Bill McKibben, environmentalist, co-founder of 350.org, a grassroots organization that fights global warming and pollution. He's the author of Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thank you, John.
Bike riders of Takeaway Nation, unite.
On bike, grinding uphill, I loathe you, gravity.
Pump uphill from home.
A hodgepodge of parts.
Two wheels, sound with chain, beating hearts, tied to nothing.
Every bike since held me up.
We are young. Once more.
My bike does me right.
All this week on The Takeaway, we've got bicycles on the mind. We want to hear from you.
As I zip through town, my helmet hides my gray hair. I am fast again.
Riding on the road, cars rush by without concern. Prayers propel me on.
I've had many bikes, but a number were stolen. Is that a bike share?
As you can hear there, The Takeaway has launched a nationwide bike challenge. Submit a haiku about your bike or bike riding experience, or maybe why you hate biking altogether. Visit our website at thetakeaway.org to enter to win our Takeaway Bike Challenge. Three judges will vote and select their top 10 picks, and winners will get Takeaway bike helmets. Now, that's something really valuable. Submissions are being accepted until 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, September 22nd. And this is all motivated by our observation of the success of bike share programs around the nation. They've raised the profile of bicycle culture, but what about the impact on the friendly bike shop down the street? Charlie McCorkle is the owner of Bicycle Habitat in New York City. He's a little nervous about the impact of the City bike share program on his business. But Ashante Austin has been coexisting with bike share a little bit longer. She's co-owner of the Hub Bike Co-op in Minneapolis, where the Nice Ride program has been nice for business.
Bike share couldn't get off the ground without the bike shops here in the Twin Cities. I mean, for example, we actually repair bikes from Nice Ride, which is our bike share program here. And that helps us because what it does is it drives people into the bike shops. I feel like it's been a great collaboration and it's really increased the awareness of cycling. Drivers are able to see that the city itself is behind cyclists and are encouraging folks to commute and, in a sense, lobbying for folks to be aware that cycling is an alternative transportation.
Well, that's good. Evangelizing the message of cycling, that's what Rideshare has done in the Twin Cities, or Nice Ride has done in the Twin Cities. Charlie McCorkle, we're a little newer to the rideshare program here in the New York City area. What are you what are you finding, Charlie?
Well, I interviewed a lot of bike dealers in bike share cities, and they all told me to expect an immediate drop and then a long-term gain. We're still in that immediate drop period. As you noted, the rental bikes are falling off significantly. I almost characterize it as falling off a cliff. We've seen a big drop in the fixing flats, the basic repairs that you need day-to-day, because I think a number of people have switched over to the bike share in the short run. City Bike in New York City has done a great job of proselytizing for helmets. So that's been one area where we've seen a tremendous growth in our business, maybe as much as 25%, which is a pretty big number. And that's been really helpful for us.
And thanks, by the way, for our bike contest that we're doing, the haikus. Listeners are sending haikus that say what their bike ride means to them, what their bike means to them. You've donated some helmets to us, and thanks so much for that.
Yeah, it's our pleasure.
And have you noticed that bike culture is changing in the city of New York, that there's more of a sense of a bike is there for you, that this is a part of the public transportation system in a way that it never has before?
I'm sure you've seen the numbers that they've been touting in New York City the last couple of days. 3 million trips in 4 months, 6 million miles. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely incredible. It's almost a contagion of those of us on bikes.
So we've got the sky blue colors here in New York. What are the colors of Nice Ride, Ashanti, in the Twin Cities?
It's neon green.
Neon green. All right. Yeah. And so giving people an idea that they have access to bikes doesn't necessarily mean that they don't want to purchase their own. Have you had no negative impacts, Ashanti?
For us, it's hard to attribute some of the losses that we've seen to actually Nice Ride. It's definitely hard to attribute it to that, particularly since here in Minnesota, our season is so short. When winter hits, nobody's riding our bikes. And I would like to actually see the bikes here, the Nice Ride bikes, equipped to handle winter. That would be pretty much part of the problem.
Another mountain to climb. Ashanti Austin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ashanti Austin is co-owner of the Hub Bike Co-op in Minneapolis, and Charlie McCorkle, owner of Bicycle Habitat here in New York City. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
So you share bikes and bus seats, you check into a hotel, you're using the same room someone else used last night. How far does this rental business go? Would you rent some clothes for a one-time occasion, a wedding, a rented tuxedo for graduation, nice dress? Where did you rent it?
Across many different sectors of the economy, I saw that consumers had more willingness to rent things. We see this in the music business where we've gone from buying songs on iTunes to renting our music via services like Spotify. Or in transportation, we're using services today like Zipcar, Uber, Halo, Lyft, and we found that around 50% of an American woman's closet was comprised of things that she'd only worn once. So I saw a real opportunity for rental to become a part of the retail space.
An opportunity for Jennifer Hyman speaking there, co-founder and CEO of Rent the Runway, a company that allows brand-conscious but cash-challenged fashionistas to show up in a $1,900 Vera Wang dress for less than three Benjamins or sport a $500 Oscar de la Renta necklace for just $90. Are consumers much more willing to consider renting over ownership these days? Arun Sundararajan is a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business and an expert in the sharing economy. He joins us today from San Francisco. Arun, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here, John.
So what is the sharing economy writ large? It's bigger, actually, than just consumer goods.
Yes. What I find most interesting about the sharing economy are the new peer-to-peer marketplaces like Airbnb and Relay Rides and Snapgoods that are allowing people who own stuff to rent it to other people who want it for a price. And so that's the sector of the sharing economy that I think is growing most rapidly. These internet-enabled marketplaces that allow us to move from a model of ownership-based consumption to a model of shared consumption.
So it's not only people who want to have less stuff in their lives, it's also people who want to use the stuff that they have and make money off it by offering it for rental or for sharing.
Absolutely. People who want less stuff in their lives, it's people who perhaps want a greater level of choice. People who say, well, if I own something, there's just one instance of it that I own. If I buy a car, then that's my car for 3 years. If, on the other hand, I don't buy a car and I choose to rent it from my peers, then I can drive a different car. And so we've got sort of a considerable increase in variety as well, in addition to people reducing the amount of stuff in their lives and people being able to make money off the stuff that they actually own.
So what are the drivers here? Is it population? Is it lack of space or reduced space in real estate, in apartments, in cities, density in city living that's driving this on some level?
The timing of this it's actually interesting to think about why it's happening now. All of the points that you brought up are certainly drivers of why sharing is a good value proposition. You know, it works in densely populated urban areas. For the first time in, I think, recent history, we are actually seeing an influx of people into cities, especially people of the millennial generation. But I think why it's happening now is a combination of two or three factors. One is that we've got these powerful mobile devices that we carry around in our pockets all the time. We've got social media and sites like Facebook that facilitate a greater level of trust between peers. And so, you know, I can more safely rent something from someone who I don't really know rather than simply sort of renting it or borrowing it from my friends. And I think we've also gotten comfortable with the idea of getting stuff on the other side of the internet because we've been using peer-to-peer file sharing networks for over a decade.
And these reinforce the idea that the ownership of something is a transitory experience. It's something that you only need for the occasion. The actual ownership of the thing that requires storage becomes less intuitive. And add to that the idea that we're recycling more. So the idea that you can use something that is used is much more a natural impulse.
That's true. I mean, I think there's a much greater level of comfort that people have with the idea that usage is not the same as ownership. They're certainly driven in part by, you know, the trend of moving, even in the digital space, from owning music to renting it. So that level of comfort is certainly there that, you know, it doesn't have to be mine for me to use it. And in fact, if it's not mine, then my choice is expanded dramatically because instead of 2,000 songs, I've got 15,000. Instead of 500 books, I've got a million. And so, you know, that notion that sharing doesn't imply an inferior consumption experience, but a superior one, I'm starting to see that among the sort of the early adopters of the sharing economy.
So a projection of wealth because of your access to far more consumer goods, but less cash outlay to actually own this. Does the implication for retail, is it dire? Does it kill retail? Does it kill closet organizer businesses? I mean, what are the implications as this ripples through the economy? Because we're moving beyond early adopters now.
Well, what history really suggests is this kind of technology-driven change, which makes production more efficient, which makes the producing of stuff possible with less, will always, in the long run, expand the economy.
Arun Sundararajan is a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business, an expert on the sharing economy. Thanks so much, Arun.
Well, thank you, John.
Hey, this is Sean from Charleston, South Carolina. We had a bike sharing program here where our city provided a number of yellow bicycles to be placed throughout the city. And I don't know, it was a fairly short period of time before all those bikes had been stolen.
Maybe they shouldn't have been yellow. Maybe they should have been neon green like Minneapolis or goofy blue like here in New York. Sean's sharing experience in Charleston showed a city maybe a little ahead of its time back in 1996. But one of you in Austin, Texas can't wait for the bike share. We get by in Texas with one car thanks to Car2Go and are excited for bike share to come. Share your sharing experience with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us what you share in your community.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
The world can present itself as a vast, forbidding place to all but the idealists and adventurers who are driven by insatiable wanderlust and a hunger for adventure. Amanda Lindhout knew she would be a world traveler from the moment she could pack her suitcase.
She spent years traveling throughout Asia, the Middle East, and Africa before she ended up in Somalia as a 27-year-old freelance journalist. Lindhout's experience of youthful invulnerability ended abruptly, though, when she was abducted along with fellow journalist Nigel Brennan while they were investigating a refugee story. They remained in the custody of their kidnappers for 460 days. She was starved, isolated, and sexually abused, but she survived and was eventually released when her family was able to come up with enough money to pay a ransom. She chronicled her heartbreaking loss of innocence in a new book, A House in the Sky. It is a painful story, Amanda Lindhout tells. But surprisingly, in the end, it is an experience she does not entirely regret.
The day that I was abducted on the outskirts of Mogadishu on this dusty road, and our vehicle was stopped by this group of teenage boys with their faces wrapped in checkered scarves holding AK-47s, it was hard to comprehend what was happening. I wanted to believe it was going to be over soon, that it was a robbery, or maybe they'd let me go when they realized that I was in the country, because as a freelance journalist, I cared about what was happening there. But when I learned that what they were after was a ransom, and I knew that my government, the Canadian government, doesn't pay ransoms, and coming from a family of absolutely no financial wealth, I knew that it was not going to be over quickly. And in fact, my captors made it known to me that they would hold me for as long as it took. And I knew that it was not going to be over quickly.
And I suspect what maybe comes back most vividly is not the words that were said or what it even looked like, but that feeling in your gut when you knew that there was no clear end to this.
Yeah, it's, you know, people ask me, you know, what's it like to be kidnapped? And it is that sense of not knowing when it was going to end. And, you know, at times, at the darkest times, if it was going to end, if I was actually going to survive. I went through so many different stages in those 460 days that I was a hostage. There was initially, you know, a sense of disbelief, and then acceptance that this was my new reality. And as time went on, and my captors grew, you know, increasingly frustrated that this was taking so long, and the treatment grew worse and worse and worse, you know, I really, really fell into the depths of despair. And it was after a certain point, when I was just so far into that darkness of my own mind, that I discovered something really surprising, which was, you know, also the strength that we have within us, the capacity that I found within myself to survive and to want to survive that.
Take me through a day for you alone, or for you and your partner, who is also kidnapped with you. How do you pass the time? How did you pass the time?
Well, for those first 3 months that an Australian photographer, Nigel Brennan, and I were kidnapped, we were held together. And so, you know, by the end of those 3 months, we were like an old married couple who would, you know, bicker with each other. And, you know, but we needed each other, and we would, you know, play games. And, you know, we had been given some acetaminophen tablets, these giant tablets like that looked like horse pills. And we were able to carve those tablets into a little pair of dice. And we would play backgammon. We had to learn how to be creative with what we had, which was essentially nothing. And when we were together, spent a lot of the time discussing strategies. And then later, after about the 5 month mark, even after we had been separated and we continued to secretly communicate, you know, executing an escape together, we really, really relied on each other.
What's it like to plan an escape, and then what's it like to be recaptured?
Planning this escape was a really desperate measure. Nigel and I used a pair of nail clippers that our kidnappers had given us to carve out crumbling mortar between some bricks that were cemented across the window in that bathroom. You know, we got away with it, and we jumped out a hole about the size of a basketball, and we ran to a nearby mosque where we hoped we were going to find some help. And we had timed it just after our middle of the day prayer, so we knew there'd be people in the mosque. But our kidnappers were in hot pursuit behind us, because of course we had made some noise when we had jumped out that window. And they chased us into the mosque with their guns, and it was terrifying, and it was devastating to be dragged out of that mosque, you know, across the floor by my ankles, out towards a truck that was waiting to take us away to everything that happened next. And that was really a defining day in our captivity. There was the experience of our captivity before the escape, which was obviously terrible. But the experience after that, everything that followed was aftermath. It was punishment for that.
How many days of punishment?
I would call the 10 months that followed that failed escape attempt punishment, every one of those days punishment. The conditions really, really deteriorated, John. My prison went from being the size of the room that I was kept in to the size of the mat that I was forced to lay on the floor. I wasn't even allowed to sit up for some months. I was forced to lie just on my side in chains on the floor in the dark for 24 hours a day. And it was really a struggle to get through not a day, but a minute. And so I really had to utilize the power of my own mind, you know, the ability to escape into imagination and memory of the life that I had and the life that I wanted to go on to live. And the longer that this experience went on, the other thing that really helped was a growing understanding of who my captors were, who these teenage boys who had taken away my freedom were, which was a product of their environment. These young adults who were completely shaped by the war and the violence of Somalia, a country that's been broken apart by two decades of war. And the clearer I got about who they were, that also helped me understand, because it humanized them to me, and it helped me look for, you know, and search for and be grateful for even any moments, no matter how small they were, of humanity that I saw in them.
What do you think the permanent impact of all this is 20 years down the line?
I think it's hard to look that far into the future, but what I can tell you, the impact that it's had 4 years after my release, which is that, you know, that trauma is something that I live with every single day. It's something that I feel like lives in the cells of my body. And that experience changed me, and it changed me in some ways for the better. I'm a person now that is much more, you know, grateful for the little things in life. And I think, you know, I really try to live each day to the fullest. But, you know, I also live with a sense of grief for, you know, what I lost, maybe the part of myself that I lost while I was in captivity.
Well, Amanda Lindhout, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks, John.
Amanda Lindhout is the author of the new book, A House in the Sky, which chronicles her 460 days in captivity in Somalia. She's also the founder of the Global Enrichment Foundation, a nonprofit that works with women in Somalia and Kenya. Listen back to anything on the program, including that conversation. You can check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks to all our new listeners in the state of Georgia. From right here in the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta, I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.